Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Susan Lavelle at St. Joseph's University. I'm recording 2 days after the U.S. Supreme Court heard a critical case on concealed carry permits in New York State. And today's guest and book could hardly be more relevant. I'm joined by Dr. Jennifer Carlson to discuss her new book, Policing and the Second Amendment, Guns, Law Enforcement, and the Politics of Race, published by Princeton University Press in 2021. When Americans talk about guns, they often use terms like gun rights or gun control. They also tend to separate gun politics and the politics of the police. Jennifer Carlson identifies the inaccuracies of both. She provides two alternative narratives of American gun talk, gun militarism and gun populism. And she believes that both clarify the stakes in today's gun debates. Based on her extensive research, using local and national newspapers, interviews with police chiefs, and observations made at gun licensing boards, she insists these two discourses reveal how race shapes how both gun politics unfold and how gun policies are created to differentiate between legitimate violence and criminal violence. Coercive social control is organized by racialized understandings of gun violence. Carlson demonstrates the roles of the NRA, police chiefs, and gun administrators in distinguishing the boundaries of legitimate violence for both private and public gun owners. For her, linking the politics of guns with the politics of the police clarifies our political and policy debates, as well as the complex terrain negotiated each day between police and private citizens in our social lives. Dr. Jennifer Carlson is an associate professor of sociology, also of government and public policy, at the University of Arizona. Her remarkable early book, Citizen Protectors, The Everyday Politics of Guns in an Age of Decline, from Oxford 2015, has shaped the study of how guns impact American society in multiple fields. Her public-facing scholarship includes commentary in the Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, and Washington Post, and I'm just delighted to welcome Jennifer Carlson to the New Books Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we talk about the specifics of the argument in Policing the Second Amendment, would you start us off by just sharing how you came to study the impact of guns in American society?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because one of my favorite gun scholars, Kristen Goss, has often remarked on this observation that perhaps there's no area of such acute public debate and public significance that has been so understudied in certain social sciences, certainly the case in sociology, where I find my disciplinary home. So as far as my own interest in guns and studying guns from a sociological perspective, I grew up in a very conservative family. And I think that in some ways, or in many ways, my father, as sort of this conservative figure in my life growing up, has has shaped me in many ways, ways that maybe he's very happy with, and ways that maybe were rather unanticipated for him in his politics. But one of the things that it did do was really force me to take sort of a sociological lens on conservatives and how conservatives think and what conservative ideology actually means to the people who embrace it. And that's actually something when we look at sociology, sociologists tend to study the left, they tend to study liberals. And of course, you know, that's partly reflective of their own biographies and their own experiences. So I was always interested in conservative politics, but I didn't grow up with guns. So I didn't grow up in a gun-owning family. I became kind of curious about it, particularly in the sort of very, very early Obama years, just, you know, when Obama got elected for the first time, and suddenly all these stories about, you know, guns and ammo flying off the shelf, and, you know, there's this big panic buy. And, you know, as a young person who really, you know, wasn't totally politically conscious, I will say, in the early 90s, when you know, you have this president who's a Democrat, Clinton, who's passing all these, you know, the two major gun regulations at the federal level, I didn't really have a sense of that, you know, firsthand as, you know, a teenager then. And so seeing this kind of unfold with Obama felt really new. And so I thought, okay, there must be lots of sociologists thinking about this. This is such a big thing. I mean, this is not some, you know, niche aspect of American culture and American society. And it was actually pretty shocking to try and find literature that didn't engage guns as a public health problem, didn't engage guns as a problem of gun crime, but actually looked at sort of how people understand guns as objects of safety and security in their everyday lives. And so, you know, conveniently, I was trying to figure out a dissertation topic for my PhD in sociology. And I thought, this is it. Like, this is clearly the thing that I was meant to be studying in terms of my own personal background, my interests, and sort of this moment. So that's how I started thinking about guns. And I have to say, it is very sad to me that there is not more, and I should say, like, there's been a lot of surge in interest among sociologists, Angela Stroud, David Yamini, Thatcher Combs. I'm just naming a few, but, you know, there's actually Trent Stidley, Harel Shapira. I don't want to forget anyone, so I apologize. But it's actually, there's actually much more interest in this area. But yeah, it is sort of surprising that it took this long to kind of get sociologists on board. So yeah, I find that guns are an incredibly useful tool, I'll say a sociological tool, to intervene into debates, discussions, analyses surrounding a whole host of issues that are sort of at the fault lines of American society. So whether that's socioeconomic decline, neoliberalization, the end of manufacturing, gender, those are issues that I really kind of dug into with Citizen Protectors, or the politics of race, which is what really the focus is on with policing the Second Amendment. I think guns are just a really excellent window into the fault lines of American society.
The situation in political science is very similar to the situation in sociology. We have had very little, we've had some great scholarship, but we haven't had quite as much. And when I talk to legal scholars, they say that as well. And part of it may have to do with the discomfort that scholars have with guns themselves. You mentioned race, and this book is very focused on racial politics and racial lenses. You use the death of Philandro Castile, a school cafeteria supervisor, a lawfully armed American with a concealed pistol license, and, you know, as the entry point into your interrogation of guns in American society. You note how he himself understood that his license to carry a firearm was granted on terms that were really shaped by his racial identity as a Black American. You say that he knows that in order to survive being stopped by the police, he has to comply with unstated rules because he knows he can be misrecognized as a violent threat. But then you also turn to the police officer who kills Castile and emphasize how he has been taught that police who hesitate on the job could lose their lives, that he'd recently been through a bulletproof warrior training, which affected his decision to pull the trigger, even though Castile had announced the presence of a gun and his identity as a lawful carrier. And you know, you note how seeing Castile as a threat rather than an citizen protector, to quote your earlier book, you know, it is shaped by assumptions of race, particularly this idea that Black men are not just suspect criminals, but dangerous gun wielders. And you puzzle over what you call a lethal double standard. So just to start us off, expand a little bit on this double standard and why this particular death reveals gun politics as the politics of the police.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it really gets at a lot of what we're seeing with regard to how gun violence is debated, discussed, adjudicated. We're seeing this most certainly in the case of Kyle Rittenhouse, which is currently being tried. And I think it's a really core question for understanding how we draw this dividing line between criminal and legitimate violence. So I actually want to start by just kind of defining what I mean by that and explaining why that's a really central aspect of the book. So one of the things that I think happens a lot in debates about guns is we talk about gun violence, we talk about gun crime, and we're already sort of setting up the debate to be about a particular kind of violence. So violence that is bad, violence that is criminal. And we tend to that's actually kind of makes sense in a way, because in terms of both sides of the gun debate, that's what they both want to talk about, right? Once we get into this question of legitimate violence, so the violence that as a society or as dominant members or groups within society has deemed to be lawful, done with justice or what have you, suddenly that becomes very uncomfortable. There's a lot of debate around how we draw those lines. Those lines reveal very uncomfortable things to ourselves, not just that we are very comfortable in some cases with violence. I think we want to believe in, you know, what many of us believe is a democratic society, that we aren't a society, like that's the whole point of democracy, is to circumvent violence. But yet we see with, ongoing support for police as an institution that is seen as necessary, as the rejection of this recent ballot initiative in Minnesota to actually end the police department and turn it into a public safety department. That did not pass, which really suggests that people are invested in the police. And so that raises the question then of what kind of legitimate violence we're okay with. And again, we don't like to have that question because it reminds us that we're okay with violence. It also, at least some kinds of violence, and it also reminds us or forces us to confront that we have to draw lines. And oftentimes in American society, we are drawing those lines on the basis of race. So the line between what counts as criminal and what counts as legitimate is supposed to be a legal one that is colorblind, race neutral. It doesn't depend on who's wielding the violence. It depends on sort of what the violence actually is. But as we can see, that's just not the case. We see, for example, in the case of Philando Castile, here is someone who is lawfully armed. He's not actually doing anything. Obviously the narrative from the police side was that he was possibly reaching for a gun. He communicates that this is not what he's doing. But yet not even the mere presence of a gun. So we know with, like, for example, the weapons bias that, if there's a vague object, if it's associated with a person of color, it's more likely to be seen as a gun. If it's associated with a white person, it is less likely to be seen as a gun. And there's a whole lot of other really interesting aspects with regard to the weapons bias. And so what we see with Philando Castile is there's not even an object there. He is just, there's just the notion that a gun is present near an African-American man who is stopped by the police because he fits the description, which Philando Castile throughout his life had many, many experiences of fitting the description and experiencing police stops as a result. So he's not new to this sort of ritual of racial degradation. That what we see is that this police officer sees him, cannot in that moment see him as anything but a threat, and then that obviously escalates to the murder of Philando Castile. And so I think what that shows is sort of first of all, obviously that race shapes how, you know, that the license in itself is a license to carry a gun. And I think this goes back to sort of themes that are discussed in this recent U.S. Supreme Court case that was just, you know, the oral arguments were just heard a couple days ago. You know, in terms of what a gun license actually gives you and allows you to do, that license is administered on racial terms, not because there's an explicit racial, you know, language related to, you know, written in the law with respect to the license, but because that license depends on people like law enforcement, people recognizing that license as a legitimate permission for you to carry a gun. And so, you know, when we have these kind of, you know, broad debates about, you know, gun laws and what have you, we have to put the police in those debates because the police are the ones who are actually executing and enacting these laws. So that's kind of, you know, kind of a response to this question of double standards with regard to race and the capacity, not just to get the license, but to actually carry it and to engage gun politics as an everyday practice, which is something I talk a lot about in Citizen Protectors. But then the other thing I think that, and I just want to add this in terms of thinking about Philando Castile, you know, this was a case that actually really, for a moment, scrambled sort of the sides of the gun debate. You had, you know, writers in the New York Times saying, hey, I thought this was a right for everybody. So, you know, obviously we may not be totally comfortable with how this, you know, with concealed carry or what have you, but like, this is very hypocritical with regard to race. You also had writers, you know, in the National Review saying like, look, there was something gravely wrong that happened here. You had NRA members basically asking the NRA, demanding that the NRA actually say something about the case. The NRA doesn't say anything except basically the vaguest thing it can the organization can possibly say. And that week is also the week when police officers were killed in Dallas at a protest, at a Black Lives Matter protest. And that's where we hear the NRA really coming out clear in terms of their defense of police officers. And so that, again, also alerts us to there's something going on beyond, you know, the race and guns. That's part of the piece, but we can't understand that piece without also putting the police into the mix as well. So I think the Philando Castile case really opens up these questions and illuminates, obviously, why we need to talk about race with respect to guns, but also why we need to talk about police as well.
So before we go deeper into the argument of the book, let's just talk a little bit about methods and data, because you have three different types of actors that you think shape the relationship between the politics of guns and the politics of police. You also have a diverse country with 50 states that define rules for carrying guns differently. So what type of evidence did you look at, and how did you pick the three states, Arizona, Michigan, and California, to get a result that would give you a more general idea of how the United States thinks about guns?
Yeah. So for this book, what I really wanted to do, as I've already mentioned, is really insert police into the debate, not just as, you know, people who have an opinion about guns, but who are also actively involved in constructing the gun debate, resisting the terms of it, reproducing the terms of it, as well as actually enacting gun law at the street level. And this is something that I just, it's so rarely discussed and yet so consequential in terms of the gun laws that we pass at the legislative level. So for that reason, obviously I wanted to get sort of a historical viewpoint of how did we get to the point where you actually have police, and when I say police, I'm going to talk about the specific, you know, areas of the police community that I talked to and researched. Obviously, policing is a very broad category in the U.S. You have private police, you have sheriffs, you have municipal law enforcement, but you can see very much very high-profile police spokespeople, I'll say, on both sides of the gun debate, arguing for that side. And so, you know, it's not a given that police would naturally be allied to one side or the other, even though I think both sides sort of imagine, like, well, police, they they understand the importance of defense against crime, so they're going to be pro-gun rights. Or, you know, police are the ones who are interfacing with the public. They don't want an armed public, so they're obviously going to be in favor of gun control. And so what I found was that to get to the point where we are, which, you know, according to the Pew data that I cite in the book, police, and this is like law enforcement, public law enforcement, there's a great actual like survey of public law enforcement. So this, we don't usually get these kind of data, but just as I was writing the book, this data dropped. It actually showed that police in the majority support gun rights over gun control, and they do so at a pace that appears to be that appears to far outpace the general public. So the first question was sort of, you know, how did we get to this point? And so I rely on basically reconstructing a history of gun politics from the perspective by centering the police. I spent a lot of time thinking and reading about, you know, NRA initiatives. I look at local news reports and that sort of thing. So that's one piece of the puzzle, sort of this archival work. But then the real meat of the book looks at the contemporary context. As you mentioned, I focus on three states: Arizona, California, and Michigan. And you're totally right. You know, this may change actually by the end of, or by, you know, mid-year 2022, in terms of the differences across states, depending on how the Supreme Court decides this recent case. But for now, there's actually a pretty big divergence with regard to the kinds of gun regimes that people in the U.S. may be living under. So the way I cut it up is that I see three dominant regimes: gun lax, gun permissive, and gun restrictive. So Arizona, where I live, is one of the sort of quintessential gun lax states. Basically, we have the regulatory and bureaucratic apparatus that's sort of set as a minimum by the federal government, but not much beyond that. And we have a lot of laws that actually loosen gun restrictions beyond that, or rather allow you to do things with guns that you may not be able to do in other states. So we actually have a brandishing law that is very different in Arizona versus other states. We have stand your ground. We have, you can get a permit to carry a gun, but you can also carry permitless. If you can legally own it, you can legally carry it. So basically, you can pretty much, assuming you, again, meet the federal guidelines and the federal bar, you could pretty much do whatever you want with a gun in Arizona without much of a bureaucratic apparatus to jump through. Now, Michigan is my gun permissive state, and I really mean permissive, not just as sort of a throwaway, like, you're able to do a lot, but also that you need permission. So in most of the things that are legal in Arizona are also legal in Michigan, but you need to go through some kind of bureaucratic apparatus to be able to do them. So for example, there is gun registration in Michigan. There is a concealed pistol licensing apparatus in Michigan. It's not yet permitless. And so it's a very, I think most people would say to see it at one time as a pro-gun state, although I think as permitless regimes become more dominant, people may have different thoughts about Michigan. And then California, of course, is the gun restrictive state. And so restrictive, both in terms of there is many of the things that you can do in Arizona and Michigan, you cannot do. There's no legal way to do them in California. There are bans on ammo, bans on magazine capacity on certain kinds of guns. There is, and this has gone back and forth in terms of the courts, but there's a real push to actually have background checks even for ammunition. And of course, there's a huge bureaucratic apparatus to enforce all of this. California actually has its own background check system in addition to the federal background check system. They also have a list called the Armed and Prohibited Persons List that basically is a list of people who at one point registered a gun with the state of California and did something to make them ineligible to own a gun. And so there's these lists that exist of people who could have guns. It's not clear because that's a whole nother can of worms in terms of enforcing gun seizures and that sort of thing. And so that's another aspect that's very, very different about California. So these states, but when I say different, it's distinctive in terms of these other regimes. I think that we can actually look at California, Arizona, and Michigan as sort of three states that tell us a lot about more generally the terrain of gun regimes in the U.S. So what I did is I went to those three states. I talked to police chiefs across those three states. I wanted to know is the, you know, how they understand guns, is that different across these three states? Does it depend on how, you know, not just what they think about guns abstractly, but the laws that they're actually enforcing with regard to gun policy? So that's piece number two. So the last piece of the book is looking at how gun laws are actually enforced. And what is tricky about this is that a lot of the decisions that would be really helpful to be able to observe with respect to kind of nailing out, finding out, tracing out bias, we can't actually observe them because gun licensing decisions, the decision of a licensing official with respect to whether or not to give someone, for example, a concealed pistol license, that's not made in a public forum. Those records cannot be FOIA'd. And so it becomes a real conundrum because you have these laws that on the face of it don't appear to be racially biased. They don't have racially explicit language that would lead us to think that they necessarily are going to result in racial biases. Of course, though, we know that there's lots of ways in which racial bias arises, particularly when we think about criminalization and the criminalization of Blackness, that you don't need explicit racial language to craft a law that ends up having racially biased outcomes. So this becomes a really big problem because as we hear a lot in debates about gun carry legislation, particularly shall issue legislation, that it's non-discretionary, that there's no bias, that this is, you know, race neutral and all of these things. But we actually really don't know because we can't actually see how people are making decisions and if there actually are disparate outcomes. So I was very lucky. I actually caught the tail end of an institution in Michigan that lasted for roughly 100 years, the gun board. And these are public forums in Michigan where people who have their gun licenses to carry, so concealed pistol licenses, they if they have their licenses suspended, revoked, or denied, they can come to this gun board and basically explain why, you know, either how to address the situation or how to overturn the decision. And so what this did for me was actually allow me to see how licensing officials, which I should mention, tend to be from the police. So almost all of the administrators at these gun boards were either there on behalf of the police as representatives of the police, for example, the Michigan State Police, or they had some kind of law enforcement affiliation or background. So it really provided me with a space to really clearly focus in on how gun licensing decisions were made. And what I found was that it's not the case that race just doesn't enter the room when you write laws that don't explicitly mention race, but in fact enters the room through, we could say, the back door with, emphasis on things like police contact, danger to self and others, and that sort of thing. So that's how I build my case in terms of the book with those three pockets of data.
So that extensive research reveals two discourses that motivate the book. And you write that, you know, you aim to, and I'm just going to quote the book here, trace different impulses, gun militarism and gun populism, with regard to the organization of legitimate violence, public law enforcement, and gun access in the United States. And as the remarkable title implies, you believe that policing the Second Amendment is not just about regulating guns, but insisting on a particular understanding of what constitutes legitimate violence and how it should be distributed across society. And you're arguing that these two discourses are implicitly and explicitly embedded in racial ideas surrounding law and order. So let's start with just really brief descriptions of the two discourses, because I also want to get us through the chapters because they really take the methods that you're using and the type of data, and you can see how each chapter plays out all of this rich material that you've collected. So a lot of times Americans talk about gun control, gun safety, gun rights, but you don't think those are the right lenses. So would you just briefly explain the discourse that is gun militarism, that you call gun militarism, and gun populism before we go through the argument that comes out in the chapters?
Yeah, thank you for that question. Gun militarism and gun populism are really sort of the two big ideas from the book and the two terms that I really try and invest in the book and develop, because I think that they are more illuminating with regard to giving us coordinates of the debate as it unfolds, the gun debate as it unfolds in the U.S. So when we think about gun militarism and gun populism, the reason that I wanted to come up with these terms is to name sort of these imaginaries that people, and it's actually not, they don't map onto the gun rights versus gun control side. They actually crisscross across those two sides, because they're not about sort of the place of guns just abstractly in society and where, you know, what the place of guns should be, but they're the place of guns sort of refracted through the lens of race and racial politics in the US. So gun militarism, I think, is a very, the easier term to kind of wrap our heads around, because it's very much embedded in sort of this war on crime mentality of, police are warriors, they're soldiers on the front line of violence. They need to be given every tool possible to fight this war. And it's a war that's not just fought against anyone. It's a war fought against, imagined to be fought against sort of these archetypes of racialized criminality, the gangbanger, the drug dealer, the thug, these categories that are very much associated with urban communities of color, particularly African American boys and men, who are imagined as these kind of hyper violent criminals that that police need to basically be able to pull out all the stops in order to address their violence. And so, gun militarism really captures this idea that when we're thinking about guns and gun regulations, it's a war, it's a military endeavor, and it is fought along these kind of stark racial lines. And so the key kind of objective is to empower the police, give them bigger guns, and get the enemy disarmed. When you look at the argument in the book regarding sort of the reconstruction of the debate regarding the politics of guns through the lens of police, you see very clearly that this is how police get pulled into support for the assault weapons ban, for example. Daryl Gates, who was chief of LAPD, I mean, you just read his words, and it's so clear that his support of banning assault weapons was really about disarming, and you can read his words, I'm not going to repeat them, but disarming racialized, what he imagined as, the urban criminals of LA and beyond. So that's gun militarism, and I actually see that across my three states, and that actually makes sense, because the sort of ideology that it's embedded in, this war on crime ideology, is pretty rampant across the U.S. It's pretty consistent across the U.S. And most certainly Michigan, California, and Arizona are three states that have heavily invested in sort of the war on crime. Gun populism, though, is a little different. And so gun populism forces us to shift away from sort of the over-policing of urban communities and the under-policing, or what has been called the under-policing, of suburban and rural communities. And so what I try to argue in the book is that this over-policing, under-policing paradox that's often discussed is very useful for understanding the experience of racially marginalized communities vis-a-vis the police. But it has a problematic sort of analytical consequence when we try and use it to understand, for example, predominantly white communities, because it suggests that there's just like no policing there, that it's just this kind of idealized, white picket fence sort of context. And that's not actually what's going on. There's a distinctive racial logic of policing that's happening in those communities. And what gun populism does is sort of get at this very different relationship between police and the community that they police. So how this kind of got activated when I talked to police chiefs about guns and gun violence was with respect to this sort of specter of active shootings, this brand of gun violence, which, obviously we can look at the data and there's a lot to be said about whether the sort of imaginary of active shootings actually maps onto what the actual data show about active shootings. But there's most certainly this sense of, active shootings are utterly unpredictable. They emerge, people who snapped, people who, are not of the community, but somehow really shake the community to its core. I heard police very much kind of seen active shooting as violence that's happening in places where violence shouldn't happen. Now, of course, that is an absolutely classed and racialized claim that is embedded in this idea of suburban and rural America as sort of these idyllic spaces with regard to violence. And so what police sort of think through, or what my interviews show about how police think through gun violence in suburban and rural communities is not so much like the impulse is not so much to disarm the community and aggressively police under the sort of warrior mentality, but actually have a very different emotional valence. So one of the things that I found really fascinating with police as they talked about active shootings was this sort of emotional key that they tapped into about feeling embarrassed, feeling shame, feeling devastated if they were somehow at found themselves in the midst of an unpredictable active shooting that happened, and for example, they didn't have their guns, they were off duty and they weren't carrying their guns. They would say things like, I don't care if, the guy next to me, and I'm paraphrasing here, but whether he's an off duty cop, he's an everyday civilian, if he's armed and he needs to be backup, he's going to be backup. Like, that's what we need to stop this threat. And so that is obviously that's very different than sort of how violent, the emotionality of violence in urban communities of color is sort of translated for police. And it very much puts everyday civilians not necessarily on the level of police. So police are not saying like, oh, I want, I just want everybody to be armed and then we'll just have this like, posse, this like, right. True citizens militia or something. Not everybody was, at that level, but they definitely did not see citizens, everyday citizens, as a threat. They saw them as actually a possible, advantage to public safety. And to bring this back to race, what I found was when they talked about sort of the good citizen with a gun, it was often with code words like the farmer, the teacher, the, these kind of middle class, white, often masculine, although not always, sort of labels for understanding like who the good guy with a gun is.
Okay, so the armed citizen can be a collaborator in the work that the police are trying to do, and that's part of what defines your gun populism narrative. So the first chapter looks at the relationship between the NRA and US public law enforcement. And we usually think of the NRA as a lobbying organization representing the interests of individual gun owners and the firearms industry. But how is it that the NRA shaped our expectations about what the police do? And how does race map onto those expectations? And the book is so detailed on this, and I know it's going to be very, very hard to be brief, but in the sort of short version of it, so that we can get the entire argument presented for everybody. So like, this was so surprising to me. So explain a little bit about what happens with the NRA.
Yeah. So what happens with the NRA, I think in order to sort of unpack the NRA and its development, not just with police, but in general over the past century, I really find Matthew Lacombe's new book, Firepower, really illuminating. It just came out, so I don't talk about it in the book. But he talks about the shift from the NRA from a quasi-government organization to a partisan organization. And with that sort of quasi-government organization, within that context, the NRA in its early years is really focused on supporting the U.S. military, supporting training, and training not just for, hunting, but, military, sports shooting, competitions, and that sort of thing. Now, the NRA still totally does all that stuff. And I think that's something that is often overlooked in the gun debate, just how much the training aspect of the NRA matters and how much they do in terms of that. But that's actually where we see the first sort of intervention with regard to the NRA and the police, which is that as early as 1916, you actually have calls from within the NRA saying, police need to be trained. So, you know, you have, you know, the sense that violence is rising. So this is actually not the war on crime, the war on alcohol, as some historians have called it. And so you have within this context, the NRA actually saying police need to be able to shoot well. They need to be able, criminals need to fear them and not just think, oh, wow, the police pulled out their gun and they're probably going to miss. And this is also, I mean, what's important, I think, to understand about this is a time where like police and this relationship between police identity and guns is not really solidified. So like today, it's very difficult to imagine police without guns, right? In the US context, like that is just so core to the policing role as it unfolds in the US. But like at this point in history, in the early 1900s, police didn't even have standard issued firearms. Like if they had firearms in most jurisdictions, they were their firearms or firearms that they weren't standard issue. Like we have with regard to not just revolvers, not just semi-automatics, but, you know, AR style firearms and what have you with police today. So what you have is the NRA sort of intervening with regard to training. And you see this kind of unfold in different ways. Obviously the FBI becomes much more involved in police training and to some extent displaces a little bit of what the NRA is doing. That's not to say, of course, that the NRA ever totally rescinded and got out of the police training, police training stuff. They still do train police. But what you have in the 1960s is actually the unfolding, obviously, the birth of the war on crime. And that sort of changes the dynamic, not just in terms of, you know, police wanting firepower, feeling that they need firepower to deal with this newfound threat of rising gun violence in many different forms. But you also have police actually starting to understand themselves, as everybody starts to understand themselves at this moment, as players in the gun debate. So like this idea of the gun debate didn't really exist prior to the 1960s in the way that it exists today. And so it's not until the 1970s when the NRA really takes this like sort of hard partisan shift and really lays the groundwork for becoming the lobbying group that we know today. But all through that, the NRA is still sort of going back and forth with the police. And so there's moments where we can see, you know, the NRA really trying to court the police. We can also see moments where police are really explicitly rejects the NRA and sort of the NRA's agenda with regard to guns. And then we see that, so we can kind of trace that out. And so that's what this chapter of the book does, is really try and trace that out. And what it finds is that you can't actually trace that out without also understanding how crime is racialized and the threat of crime is racialized, and the idea that we have to do something about crime and about gun crime, whether that means pulling guns off the street, restricting, banning certain guns, or, you know, bloating our criminal justice system, whatever it is, those conversations are happening through the lens of race, through racializing and racist designations of communities, people like the language of the super predator, for example, and you know, all the types of things that Daryl Gates, again, you can read about in the book, sort of uses to galvanize this idea that assault weapons need to be banned. It's a pretty interesting history, and it's one that I think both sides of the gun debate actually, like as they're constituted today, I think it really sheds a light on sort of the political preconditions of passing the kinds of policies that we that we may embrace on either side of the debate. And I think that the foundation for thinking through police populism and police militarism, what I think this chapter also does is say that it's not that, you know, the NRA is the police populism side and the gun control side is the police militarism or anything like that, but it actually shows how these discourses crisscross across those.
It's also a great reminder about the police force as an institution. We tend to think of it from the 21st century as highly uniform in all ways, the uniform, the uniform guns, the training. But the chapter really, really underlines how that is a fairly recent phenomena and that the NRA plays a role in the development of that. You have the most remarkable material from your extensive interviews with the police chiefs from the three representative states. Very briefly, what is it that these chiefs see as their role, and how are they using those two discourses to describe their roles?
Yeah, I think that's super interesting. So I'll start with the question of discourses, and I'm glad you asked that, because I think one of the readings of this book that is some that is not my intention, and so I want to just kind of push back on that, is this idea that there's, again, like police who are oriented to one sort of way of thinking about guns versus the other. And that's not the case. It's not that all the urban chiefs talked about gun militarism and all the suburban and rural chiefs talked about gun populism. It was rather that they would strategically draw on these imaginaries to make sense of gun violence and try and make sense of what to do about gun violence. So, you know, these are very much, police are very much concerned. I mean, it's funny because I'm about to say this, but I think about when I say it, I think about a chief that kind of parroted this and was like, yeah, that's what we all say. But I do think that chiefs are motivated by public safety. Now it's public safety refracted through training, experiences on the job. We all know about, you know, police cynicism and all this. But I think that they define what they are trying to advocate for with regard to guns, with respect to protecting innocent victims from violence, criminal violence. But of course, the question then is, what is criminal violence and what constitutes innocence, and who can be innocent? And so that's something that I found that was really fascinating with my chiefs, is how innocence. So, you know, we've talked about like the good guy with the gun versus the bad guy with the gun. There's also the question of who is an innocent victim of gun violence. And one of the things that came out was that it became very clear that certain groups of people just couldn't be innocent. They couldn't be, and by extension, then looping back to the good guy versus the bad guy with the gun, they couldn't legitimately use guns in self-defense. And so they kind of had that right rescinded. And so very much, and I talk about, I get in kind of the weeds with regard to the felony murder doctrine and sort of how there's this sort of one drop rule of criminal involvement with respect to urban crime that really makes it very difficult for based on my interviews, for people within the police community to see certain groups within urban communities of color as innocent victims rather than people who live a criminal lifestyle and that's why they got exposed to gun violence, which is obviously completely different than how they understand the victims of active shootings, who are, you know, they're school children, they're innocent, they're vulnerable. They deserve 100% of what the police can give them in terms of, there's no moral question about their deservingness with regard to their victimization. I think
that's great. And honestly, you've covered so much of what happens in the chapters of the book, and that's actually a challenge, because this book moves between broad theoretical claims, which you have built from this extensive data, and also a really convincing summary of that data. I mean, this is a great book to read. It's beautifully written. It's very succinct. It's remarkable. I found it fabulous. And I think it's accessible for those people listening. I think it's accessible to assign to undergraduates, to graduate students. It's certainly essential for anybody doing any research on Second Amendment, on Stand Your Ground. And I can't speak to the disciplines in sociology who would use it, but I can see it also being a case study for many other ways that sociologists are trying to figure out social patterns. Your conclusion insists that separating the politics of police and the politics of gun is toxic. And I'm wondering, given the connections that you've made, what is possible in terms of reform in the United States as you see it?
I mean, there's the question of what's possible and what's possible. I think that, this is a very, we keep using the term unprecedented, and I don't want to use that term again. But we are actually at a very unique moment, I think, with regard to gun policy. Obviously, there's a Supreme Court case that was the oral arguments of which were just heard this week that involves the question of of permitting regimes across the U.S. And, you know, it's unclear, obviously, how the court will decide narrowly, broadly, but it could have a very massive effect on states' abilities to regulate concealed carry in public. And one of the things that I found that I find really interesting when we have these debates, and I'm going to loop back to comments that I said at the top of the hour, which is that, first of all, we often don't talk about race in a very sophisticated way. Race is often it's often used as a way to disparage the other side. It's the other side is racist, and I've said my piece, and so that's all I'm going to engage. There's not introspection with regard to how race shapes both sides of the gun debate, and I really mean that. Like I really think that in itself would be a really massive elevation of the gun debate if both sides would not just focus on race as a way to win an argument, but a way to understand the terrain of gun violence and gun trauma that we have become very much normalized and accepting of in this country. And we, there's different categories of we. And so I do want to acknowledge that as well. And then I think the other piece of that is that we pass gun laws with the notion that, well, they're passed. And so, you know, there's this, and I'm going to be very glib right now, but, you know, oh, well, there's these studies that say this is bad or this is good or this is going to have that impact. And so let's pass it. And then, yay, we're done. We did our great thing. Well, okay. So first of all, passing laws is a conundrum in itself. But once you pass those laws, you don't know, if you don't actually understand how they're being implicated and implemented and enacted within the communities that are impacted by them, you actually don't have a good sense of what the actual impact of those laws are going to be. Now, obviously, one of the great examples of this is the assault weapons ban, which many have argued actually just created backlash and emboldened and empowered the NRA throughout the 1990s. And in some ways, very much had the opposite effect that it was intended to have in terms of the very long game of gun restrictions. Another example of that would be, and I'm going to get a little bit in the weeds, but I think it's so fascinating that I think it's worth to unpack. So one of the questions I often get asked are, why were police willing to talk to me? And I think that, you know, there's different answers for different police chiefs for sure with that. But California in particular, I think one of the reasons that chiefs were willing to talk to me and interested in talking to me was that they were really aggrieved by the rollback of the war on crime. They saw many of the state of California's laws regarding guns as hypocritical in the face of the rollback of the war on crime. And this is, you know, this is ongoing. And one of the things that I found talking to them was the way that their experience of the California assault weapons ban actually politicized them inadvertently, which that ban, the way it works is that police have they are able to own banned guns under that ban, under the California state ban. But once they retire, those guns they can no longer own. And so basically what you're doing is giving them something attached to their status as police, taking it away, in some cases, really bringing up some big issues in terms of like, who's going to pay for that gun now, because the departments will take it back, but they don't necessarily have money to pay. So it opens this whole can of worms that might sound really small and silly if you're like, you know, writing laws and you're a lobbyist, you're a policymaker. But actually, for the people who experience that, that's one more thing to push them into seeing these laws as poorly thought out, hypocritical. You know, because they're saying, well, what's the difference between, you know, today when I'm in the police and tomorrow when I'm retired, and now suddenly I can't have this gun. And so there's these little crevices that actually end up pulling people to one side of the debate or the other that you can't even really grasp without understanding how gun laws actually implemented and enacted on the ground, and police are the crucial sort of actors to make sense of that. So I think that in terms of, I don't end the book with a big policy prescription. I think it's actually somewhat problematic that sometimes gun books feel that they have to do that when their data are not actually showing them that. That's not what their data are showing. It'd be odd to say like, and we should have universal background checks. That's for other scholars to look at. What my scholarship looks at is how do we elevate this debate so that when we're debating whatever we're debating, we're not just using guns to talk about something that we're too uncomfortable to talk about directly.
Now, and as you've noted a couple of times, we're talking 2 days after the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in this challenge to New York's concealed carry license procedure. And as I was listening to it, and I just about finished your book, I hadn't completely finished your book while I was listening to the oral arguments. For me, the book was really, really helpful because the two narratives were swirling around the oral arguments. You have justices who are assuming that an armed citizen is an assistant to the police, and they are speaking in this narrative of populism, not using the word citizen protectors, but basically implying all of it. They are talking about the spaces that the police can't occupy and what should happen and whether individuals should take over the role of the police in those moments. I thought that the words legitimate violence weren't used, but that was exactly what many of the justices were talking about. So I actually think that you could use the oral arguments as an excellent explanation for what it is that you're clarifying in this book. I know that you've got a team of research assistants right now working on an NSF-funded project that is trying to unravel the impact of gun violence on gun violence survivors. I'm wondering, as we close, whether you would share, you know, what else are you working on? What can we look forward to in the not so distant future?
Yeah. So, I have a couple of projects on deck. The project that I'm in the process of wrapping up in the sort of end stages is actually a project on gun sellers during 2020. So obviously 2020 was seems to be watershed year in terms of gun sales, gun violence. And so basically this book is looking at how gun sellers, in the midst of sort of navigating and fielding all these new gun buyers, as well as just like the general sort of uncertainties of 2020 along multiple dimensions, really how they reimagine themselves as, or imagine themselves as political actors and reimagine democracy. So trying to get at sort of this question that we've all been thinking about with respect to democratic instability, democratic decline in the U.S., and using gun sellers as sort of a window into the conservative politics of that as that's unfolded. So that's been really, a lot to think through. And then, I'm also interviewing gun violence survivors to try and understand where we succeed as a society in supporting them, but oftentimes, obviously, where we fail. And I think that is both in terms of the social services and sort of the frontline work with regard to surviving gun violence, but also in terms of our political conversations about gun violence. So that's the stuff on deck.
Well, we'll look forward to them coming out and you coming back to New Books in Political Science. Before we go, we are pushing people to try to buy their books from independent bookstores, either using bookshop.org or just walking into their favorite brick and mortar. So I thought I'd ask you, if you have a favorite brick and mortar that you'd like to shout out in your area, and we'll end with that. I can also cut that question.
Yes, I do have a favorite bookstore that's local, and it's Antigone's Books in Tucson, Arizona.
Well, thank you so much. We've been talking to Jennifer Carlson about her new book, Policing and the Second Amendment, Guns, Law Enforcement, and the Politics of Race, from Princeton University Press in 2021. Jenny, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for engaging my work. Much appreciated.